You are listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
After years of drift, decline and dumbing down, at last we are reforming our examination system.
It isn't the real truth, Mr Speaker, that this policy is not about youth unemployment or bogus courses.
We will be legislating so that energy companies have to give the lowest tariff to their customers.
On course, not wavering. He's not wavering, he's drowning, Mr Speaker.
And the message from today's autumn statement is that we are making progress.
Governments pour huge sums of money into policies on crime, welfare, housing, education and employment. But everyone seems oddly shy about gathering good quality evidence on whether these interventions actually work, let alone which policy works best. Some of this, of course, is down to politicians, who might not always want their ideas subjected to fair tests. But some of the problems, I think, come from sheer scientific ignorance across all parties and civil servants. Mostly, new policies are assessed in something called a pilot, and this can tell you a lot about whether the admin systems will run okay. But running a pilot of your great new idea for a back-to-work programme, say, in a handful of job centres, tells you almost nothing about whether it really has helped people get new jobs. Maybe the economy picked up, in which case your policy will look undeservedly good. Maybe the job centres that volunteer for pilots are better run, with more ambitious staff than the average town. In medicine, we use randomised trials to test whether a treatment works, because these are regarded as the most fair test. You take 200 people, split them into two groups at random, give one treatment to one group, a different treatment to the other, and then measure how everyone's doing. That's an RCT, or randomised controlled trial. There have been hundreds of thousands done already, and you'd be struck off as a doctor for ignoring them. But to me, an intervention to improve your mood or back pain is no different to one that's supposed to get you a job. Surely if we did more randomised trials in policy, we'd find out what works and get better outcomes, better value and better lives. Jonathan Portes is an economist and director of the National Institute for Economic and Social Research.
Government spends an awful lot of money on social policy, everything from education to welfare to health, and yet in over a large range of the things we do, we don't know whether what we do works, or even if we do know it works, we don't know whether we could be spending the money better. And trials properly conducted can enable you to do things better, more efficiently, to have more impact for the same amount of money, or indeed to do things to understand that the things that you've been doing for some time simply aren't working.
So if all that's true, why don't trials get done all the time in government?
Well, there's often a view that it's easy to do trials in medicine. You just give some people a pill that has a drug in it and some other people a pill that has only sugar in it, and you see which of them die and which don't, and then you know the answer. Whereas social policy, it's all very, very complicated. There's all sorts of things going on at the same time.
But medicine is exactly like that. I mean, in medicine, there's lots of things going on for people at home that make them all completely different.
That's absolutely right. I do think that the more legitimate objection to the idea that you should just do randomised control trial on everything is that actually social policy interventions are typically quite a lot more context-specific than medicine. So, for example, if you have a drug that is effective on a certain form of breast cancer, well, it may not be quite as effective in the slums of Venezuela as it is in the rich suburbs of Cheshire, or maybe it's more effective in one than the other. But if it works in one, it'll probably work in the other. Whereas if you take, an active labour market program that's about helping disadvantaged young people to get work experience and hopefully getting them a job, it's quite possible that it will work in Cheshire, but not in Chelsea. It isn't simply often like saying, well, you know, we're giving a drug here and nothing here. These things are quite complicated, and it's quite important to understand what's going on underneath the surface.
Now, these are valid concerns. Generalisability is a huge issue in policy, but also in medicine. Clinical trials are increasingly done in developing countries, for example. But is depression in Mumbai really the same as depression in Long Beach, California? If you test a new blood pressure pill in Eastern Europe on patients who've never had blood pressure treatment before, are the results really applicable to UK patients on two pills already? These are well-recognised issues in medicine. But in reality, they simply mean that you need to do more trials in each setting. although this can take more time and money, on which more later. But first, there's another, even more awkward barrier. Wait, people say. If you run a trial on people, you're experimenting on them, perhaps without their permission. You're randomly determining who gets what service or which educational intervention. You're depriving people of something that's effective just to satisfy your scientific curiosity. Dean Carlin is a mild-mannered professor of economics at Yale, but he also heads an organisation called Innovations for Poverty Action. They use randomised controlled trials to help alleviate poverty in the developing world.
I always have two thoughts when this issue arises. The first is, in every situation I've ever dealt with, resources are scarce. And when resources are scarce, not everybody's going to get a service. And then you have to ask yourself, what's the most fair way of allocating this resource? And in a lot of cases, for non-research reasons, the answer is, let's do this randomly so that there isn't any cronyism. Now, that's not always the case. But in a lot of situations, ethics actually pushes one towards wanting to do a randomized trial. It's not a reason to not do one. The other thing that I often think about when this question is posed is it's just striking how, you know, we let psychology influence our perception of ethics a lot. And the salience of a control group bothers us in some way. But if we think about it analytically, we realize that what the randomized trial is doing is it's also allowing us to increase the benefits for future generations, for in the 5 to 20 years forward, to make better decisions then. If the randomized trial was well designed, was answering an important question that we didn't have an answer to, so it really was going to help change an allocation of some future decision, some future resource, then the ethics become really clear that if we don't do the randomized trial and we don't get that evidence, then we're harming future generations, and that's not ethical. So I think the real question that I like to ask on ethics is about whether the research should be done, period. We should only be doing studies on areas where we actually have a true, genuine knowledge gap, and this study is going to help fill that gap and push us forward so that we can make better decisions in the future. And the minute that's not happening, that's where the ethical issue arises.
So Dean and his friends get to run trials on things like saving schemes, SMS text message incentives, and financial literacy programs in Africa, Asia, and South America. But those of us in favour of more trials here have to contend with Westminster.
It shall be a government rooted in strong values, the values of justice and progress and community, the values that have guided me all my political life, but a government ready with the courage to embrace the new ideas necessary to make those values live again for today's world.
I think it was a period where, you know, you're in a new world, a government had come in after a long time of a government of a previous administration, new ideas, wanting to modernise public services, wanting to put the user right at the heart of this, and very open to new ways of doing things. So it was, if you like, fertile ground. And Tony Blair was particularly interested in delivery units and you know, trying to make sure that not just you had a policy, but if you had an outcome, that you really tracked to make sure that that policy delivered that outcome. And I think that was a really important part of the change in public sector. Now, he still had very strong beliefs about what worked and what didn't. So I think we made a lot more progress on the whole question of implementation during that period when there was a big spirit of let's modernise public services. I think it's still been hard pounding to go through the whole evidence base, getting it really early and acting on it.
Cabinet secretary under three prime ministers, the man known in Whitehall as God, or Gus O'Donnell if you insist, started with Blair and ended with Cameron. But he's also a numbers geek with a strong background in research. And under his tenure, a small team of nerds was assembled in the Cabinet office. They worked, almost under the radar, guerrilla style, on one of the first major programmes of randomised trials ever conducted in the UK.
It's very difficult, to be perfectly honest. I mean, there are constraints at the political level and there are constraints at the civil service level, if I'm honest. At the political level, it's all sorts of worries about postcode lotteries. Politicians are very nervous of trying out different policies in a way that people can say, but that's not fair. Why was someone given the opportunity to this scheme which got them into a job more quickly and those others weren't? There's also a set of worries about oh, for God's sakes, just get on and do it. You know, how long is this going to take? This is going to delay my initiative. I know this is true. You guys are the barrier to change. You know, you're just kind of pushing this into the long grass. So there's all those sorts of things. And then I think from the civil service end, there's a question about the level of training, the level of professionalisation. You do have strong experts on the economic side who basically grown up in a certain way of doing things, but not so much on randomised controlled trials. And so this is new for them, and there's not a great deal of experience around there. The Treasury will say, you know, trials cost money, RCTs cost money for uncertain future benefits. You know, they're full of snake oil salesmen coming into the Treasury saying, just spend this money now and you'll get these benefits later. I mean, in a sense, you can look back on some of the really big things that governments have done, and I think they've just felt that ideologically this is the right thing to do, and they don't want to wait for evidence. They've made up their minds that this is wrong and we go down a different route. And, you know, we do take massive risks when we do that.
In medicine, we often talk about the value of information and about how the cost of irrational prescribing is almost always much higher than the cost of the evidence necessary to stop irrational prescribing.
Yes.
Do you think the same is true in government? Do you think there are huge areas of waste that we just don't know about?
Almost certainly, yes, I'm afraid. That there are lots of policies that we've implemented and the desire to do it quickly. I think it's always difficult. I think if you look back at the history of pilots, quite often when we've launched a pilot, we've gone on to extend it even before we've actually had all of the results in from the pilot. So it's more a way of staggering the information. It's exactly the same barriers we've got to putting in evaluation. I mean, randomised control trials are fine, but actually, on their own, I think, you know, getting really good policy is about designing these things, but actually when you implement it, working out whether it's actually delivering what you thought it would. So building in a design for evaluation is as important. And of course, it has a possibility of high degree of embarrassment, that if actually it shows that policy is not working, that's rather embarrassing for ministers. So those are the kinds of barriers you're in public policy you're having to confront. Whereas in a business world, if it's not working, they want to know because it's losing the money and they want to stop it as quickly as possible.
That's a remarkable contrast to for you to sort of casually brush over, isn't it?
No, well, casually brush over, it's the world I live in and a world I've lived in for a long time. It's a dramatic change. It's a dramatic difference that trying to stop bad policies is also a hugely difficult thing.
So ministers may not want to know if their policies are failing. And of course, waste is only one possible outcome. Sometimes, with the best of intentions, governments can actively inflict harm on people through policy interventions, even when they thought they were doing good. Laura Haynes is head of policy research at the Behavioural Insights Team, set up by Gus O'Donnell in the Cabinet Office.
So a classic example is Scared Straight, which is a programme developed in the US, essentially targeting juvenile delinquents or at-risk children to try to deter them from future criminal behaviour. Now, the intervention seems relatively simple and it sounds as if, you know, probably it would be effective. The idea is that you take them into a prison and you expose them to criminals who've had a life of crime and not having much fun in prison. And the idea is that you'll deter them as a result of that. Initial results, which were not randomised trials, were suggestive that this was quite effective. They were just using a before and after intervention. And in fact, it got so much publicity that it was rolled out in the US. It even came to the UK. But no randomised trials were conducted until some time later. And a meta-analysis of a few randomised trials was pretty categorical in actually we were harming these kids by exposing them to this intervention. In fact, we would have been far better doing nothing, I think the report said, because actually these kids were much more likely to end up offending.
Now, it seems to me that this is a pretty powerful argument against anyone suggesting that randomised trials are unethical. Something expensive, something everyone thought was helping kids, was actually ruining lives, both for them and for their victims. The Behavioural Insights Team was set up by Gus O'Donnell after the coalition government came to power in the summer of 2010. Their mission was to work across all government departments, drawing on the latest academic research in the fashionable fields of behavioural economics and psychology. Now, this is often referred to as Nudge, the science of behaviour change, and it's been regarded sceptically by many in Whitehall as faddish and flaky. But this, paradoxically, might be the one reason why they had to get good quality evidence, more than anyone else. Their first randomised controlled trial was conducted just over a year ago. It was cheap as chips, but it had unexpectedly dramatic results. Laura Haynes.
We worked with the court service, so these were people who had failed to pay their court fines, despite multiple reminders, so letters telling them that if they failed to pay, that they might receive a warrant for their arrest, they might have their property confiscated. So this is a really kind of hardcore group who were pretty insistent on not paying their fines. And so what we did is run a text message trial. We wanted to find out if sending a text message reminder to these people would effectively prompt them to pay. And also, did it matter what the contents of that text message was? First trial we ran had around about 1,000 people in it. And we had a kind of control group who got no text. And then we had a bunch of text conditions. So one of them was a standard condition, just saying, so you've not paid your fine, pay immediately, or your case will be referred to the bailiffs. And then we had a few other conditions. And the really, really cool one was one in which we used the name of the individual. So we'd say, Ben, you failed to pay your fine. Pay immediately or your case will be referred to the bailiffs. And it turned out in this first trial that it was super effective. By sending a personalised text message, you increased the likelihood that people would pay from around about 5% in the no text condition to 21% in the personalised text condition.
That's not just nice because we got money out of people who owed it to the state. This also stopped people having their furniture taken away.
Absolutely. In fact, there's a significant cost to the individual when the bailiffs turn up. So yeah, it's good for the state, but it's definitely good for the person who owes money so that they're not even more indebted as a result of the experience with the bailiffs. And we ran a second trial in which we dropped the no tax condition because it was clearly underperforming. So we pulled all our statistical power into the four tax conditions. And then when we look at the effects of the different interventions on the amount people pay, we find that when we pull the two trials, actually people who receive a personalised text actually pay 41% more than people who receive a standard text. Now, I think that's a pretty cool result.
It's over a year since that first trial, and there have been several more low-cost, high-impact examples since. But now the unit's running more complex trials in areas like unemployment and justice. David Halpern is the director of the Behavioural Insights team. Despite their success, he says that gathering good quality evidence in Whitehall is often, still, a stealth project.
One thing we wouldn't do generally is go to someone as Perm Sec or a minister and say, we want to do a randomised controlled trial. Often for ministers, it can look like it's all downside to do a randomised controlled trial. You're saying the minister wants to act urgently, but you're saying, in fact, you're going to have to wait 2 years. It may come back and say your precious policy doesn't work. So you've got to start with a problem that they care about and say, actually, we've got an idea of an innovative solution. And, you know, you probably aren't going to want to try it on a national level, but here we've got this great idea. Why don't we try it on a small scale and see if it's effective? So that de facto is a randomised controlled trial. So even in terms of our language and our approach, we would flip it around. Otherwise, our way actually of working often has been to go out directly into the field. So rather than going through a Whitehall department, we might tell them what's going on in high level, but actually we found it very effective to just go and find a court or a job centre or, you know, someone in the field or a local authority who want to try something out different, and then let's get the result. And then when we got the result, then we show it around Whitehall. And one of the moments for me where it was a key pivot in our work was the Cabinet Secretary asked us we would present to all the Perm Secs who get together regularly on a Wednesday morning. And we essentially just showed them sort of 5 slides of trials and results from these trials. And it was clearly a moment where Perm Secs for the first time thought, oh my goodness, this isn't just a joke, it does actually work. So we did go that route. It was kind of a quite exciting moment, and you could feel Whitehall shifting towards, this isn't a joke, this is something we can really use.
I wonder if part of the answer might be to have structures in place to say that every new policy has to go through a kind of checklist of, could this be rolled out as a randomised trial to find out if it works or not? Would that be insane?
Well, it's definitely not insane, and the Obama administration has been edging towards that type of approach. It's actually astonishingly radical in terms of its impact, and the issue would be that most policy wouldn't get signed off because it didn't, you know, wouldn't make that grade. Certainly, if you said it has to have this kind of evidence in place. But what you certainly might imagine is to say increasingly from Treasury and elsewhere, well, yes, we'll give you some resource to do this, but a condition will be you have to have a randomised controlled trial. It's not completely unprecedented. For example, the educational maintenance allowance, when it came around, Treasury, this is, you know, nearly a decade ago, were very sceptical about it and essentially insisted on a multi-arm, pretty much randomised controlled trial. And because of that, we know exactly what the cost effectiveness of it was, and in fact it showed quite high levels of dead weight cost. But that was the exception rather than the rule. Historically, you know, if a Treasury would generally use it when it's got a policy it's a bit suspicious about, and what we're really saying here is that you have to do it routinely. But yes, I mean, if you think about even big areas of policy, like economic policy, there are lots of programs that are put together all the time. How many of them could have a randomized control built into them? Many could, is the short answer. And so, yes, we're talking to our business department and elsewhere to see as to whether we can make that happen.
So do you see this as a kind of guerrilla project? Are you infiltrating and seeding the notion of randomisation into UK government?
Well, we often actually refer to ourselves as a kind of guerrilla operation in terms of getting policymakers to use these additional approaches. But yes, it turns out that a big second strand to our work has been methodological, which is in the boring but important box. And one of the things that's being pursued, particularly actually championed by the Cabinet Secretary, is to drive essentially what are called what works centres. So in the same way we've got NICE for medicine, the question is why, when you can go to 200,000 odd clinical trials in certain areas of medicine, but if you go to the criminal justice system, you're lucky if you can find 100. So we're trying to change that, yes.
Now, this is music to my nerdy ears, but it's a concern for some who worry that building up vast databases of evidence in different areas of policy, even good evidence, could make us complacent. We might focus on the data, they say, almost like robots, and fail to consider whether a policy is appropriate, ethical, or socially acceptable. Nancy Cartwright is Professor of Philosophy at Durham University and co-author of a new book on evidence-based policy.
Indeed, it is very much a worry that people get over-optimistic or they're desperate and something that's on the shelf, something that's been labeled, this policy has worked, by a really respectable labeling commission like the Cochrane or Campbell collaboration or the What Works Clearinghouse. There's really a danger that people will just take it off the shelf and use it. And the danger isn't just that they won't think about the additional information that would help them decide whether it will indeed work for them. But the other thing is that this false optimism or false confidence or hope, it can stop people hedging their bets sufficiently. That's another worry, that because this is backed by really good study, we think it's going to work. And normally, when you put a policy in place, you think it probably won't work. I mean, most policies just don't work. Life is very, very complicated. And we do have devices that for dealing with the fact it probably won't work. We monitor it very carefully as we go along. We roll it out very slowly. But if you have too much confidence that it's going to work because it's passed some test that it works somewhere else, there is a danger that people will lose confidence in it entirely.
This raises an interesting new problem. Gathering evidence isn't just about running trials. It's also about having people who are savvy enough to interpret the studies and understand their strengths and their weaknesses. Robotically following the results of one trial can be just as foolish as ignoring all the evidence, and a little bit of knowledge can be a very dangerous thing. These concerns are echoed by Professor Martin Hammersley from the Open University.
I'm anxious not about people doing randomised controlled trials. I'm anxious about the way in which this particular method is presented on some occasions. It's presented in ways that suggest that it is a solution to all of the problems. It isn't. It's one method amongst others. It's important not to contrast evidence from randomised controlled trials with things like hunch or intuition or what people think might be the case. That there's a range of different evidence that people can draw on, and you have to judge each sort of evidence in its own terms.
But could you give me a concrete example of a situation where somebody has blindly overinterpreted the results of a randomised trial in the UK, followed its results in a very naive and arrogant fashion, and implemented it in a way that was harmful? Because this is what you're concerned about.
Well, I think the case of teaching reading and reliance on phonics is an example of that. I think that there is evidence about the effectiveness of different ways of teaching reading, and I think that from randomised controlled trials is useful. But what's happened is that that has been taken by government as proving that particular phonics-based methods are the most effective way of teaching reading, and that has been implemented as policy. That kind of a response to evidence from a randomised controlled trial is dangerous. I think it leads us into making policy decisions on an inadequate basis.
Surely the most important flaw in the evidence for phonics is that we don't have enough trials evidence.
Well, indeed, I think we need more of that, and I think we need more of evidence from randomised trials and more evidence of other kinds as well. My fear is that the results of randomised controlled trials are used or may be used by policymakers as a sort of quick fix, if you like. It avoids having to look at the whole range of evidence because you focus down on the results of a randomised controlled trial and say, well, this is the best evidence there is and this says that, so this is what we have to do.
I'm not so sure about this. Policymakers need to make binary decisions, yes or no, out of a vast cloud of information. But I don't think that necessarily means they thought the evidence was perfect when they saw it. And making this evidence better, more informative, is surely what really matters. And luckily, many others in government seem to think so too. Kevin Collins is the new chief executive of the Educational Endowment Foundation, a new independent organisation set up to do more trials in education. Armed with £200 million to spend on research over the next decade, they'll be producing evidence that could reinforce hunches, or alternatively, kick the legs right out from underneath some existing sacred cows.
It's great to report that after the first year we've got 1,000 schools who are signed up for that, and that's as many as we wanted, and there's more coming down the track as we carry on with this work. But there are some challenges. I mean, the first is around ethics.
What's the ethical objection that people raise to doing randomised trials in schools?
Sometimes you hear the question around, is it right to experiment on children? Of course, we don't experiment on children. That's not what we do. What we do is we, if you like, experiment with teaching practice and the ways we support children. Because the other side of the coin is that people are experimenting, if you like, using the same language, not the language I like really, but on children without knowing. And unless you know the effect of what you're doing, how can you be sure you're not doing harm? So what we find out is not only what works, but we also critically find out what doesn't work. And interesting, we've already found out things, and the research from other places and in Britain has found out some things that don't work and is encouraging teachers to think again about, should I keep doing that?
Could you give us an example?
A good example. The best example would be that if you reduce your class size by, say, 2 children, which is what some people have used their pupil premium, which is a significant sum of money, that actually, on the evidence, makes very little difference. There are much better ways of spending that money than taking just reduced class size by 2. If you spend your money just by popping in additional adults into the classroom without giving them the right training and right support, that won't make any difference, and yet people are doing that all the time. So we're not trying to tell people what to do, but we're trying to say at least turn to evidence to guide the decisions you make.
I'd be willing to bet large sums of money that almost anybody you ever spoke to would say what we do is based in good quality evidence.
Mm. People do say that, don't they? Because you like to believe it. I mean, it's a natural inclination, especially if you're the leader of an institution, you're responsible for large amounts of public money. You're not going to say, you know, I base all my decisions on hearsay and prejudice. But the truth is, unfortunately, that lots of decisions aren't made on good evidence. And I don't think it's about blaming people for that. I think it's about trying to create better access and support to make those decisions.
So could you just walk us through how you would do a trial comparing one method of teaching phonics against another in British schools?
Okay. To do the real example, we're very concerned, as the Deputy Prime Minister is, so he gave us some extra money to look at children who leave primary school not reading. 100,000 children left primary school last year not reading at level 4. The prospects for those children is chronic that they're going to go on to get 5 ATCs. Deputy Prime Minister said, I'm really worried about this matter, and Michael Gove as well. So they were going to release some extra money. And what they did was, £10 million, they, instead of just giving it to schools and saying, do a bit more for these children, which might have been an approach, they gave it to us. and said, get schools to make proposals about how you would tackle these children. And it's great to now say that 1 in 10 secondary schools has made a proposal. We're funding them with other schools in groups to think about this issue. Now, one bundle of them is all looking at phonics and reading. And what we will do is we will have some children in those schools who are now going to be involved in more intensive phonics work, probably at the end of year 6 and in the summer holidays as well as the beginning of year 7. And some children who in schools aren't going to be involved in that phonics work. So they're going to do another kind of dimension of reading, maybe comprehension or reading for pleasure, whatever it might be.
And you'll randomly assign schools to do one or the other?
Randomly assign them to do one or the other. And then at the end we'll be able to say to schools, do you know, the children that did more attention to phonics made this level of progress. The children who didn't made this level of progress. Now that will give you an indication of how you might emphasise your reading programme next time you have children who look like that.
So nobody's being given nothing. You're absolutely just comparing different positive
exactly
interventions.
Exactly.
I can only see good in this. Of course you can say that evidence isn't perfect, and I'd agree. I'm a research methods dork. But it's a million miles better than hunches or political expediency. And we'd all benefit from more fair tests of policies, especially when, as we saw with examples like the Scared Straight programme, hunches and grandstanding can lead you to take on a policy which does the precise polar opposite of what you hoped, actively harming children and increasing crime. And if we're talking about crime, then here's an idea that might make a lot of people very uncomfortable. Why shouldn't we use randomised trials, the flip of a coin, to find out what works best in criminal sentencing? Why can't a judge with a convict think more like a doctor with a patient and ask, what's the outcome I want to achieve, and how can I find out if my sentencing will achieve it? Sheila Bird is a statistician at the Medical Research Council's Biostatistics Unit. The MRC's 100 years old this year, and they first introduced proper randomised trials to medicine with Austin Bradford Hill's legendary streptomycin antibiotics trial in 1946. Now, Sheila Bird wants to use the same tools to help judges find out the real impact of their interventions on society.
Judges prescribe sentence on lesser evidence than doctors prescribe medicines, because we don't know what works in terms of sentencing, and also reducing the harms that many offenders are themselves vulnerable to, addictions, mental health problems.
So give me an example of a randomised trial that you would like to do in the field of criminal justice.
Let me start by giving you two examples of randomised controlled trials I would like to have done. There is no randomised controlled trial of sentencing heroin-dependent offenders to a drug treatment and testing order versus to incarceration. And yet we know that there is a very high risk of their having an overdose death in the fortnight following release from prison. So there is a substantial harm associated potentially with the consequences of incarceration for these individuals. The second example, which costs the public purse a lot of money, is electronic tagging. We have not done a randomised controlled trial to discover the benefits of electronic tagging over and above a conventional community sentence.
Now, a lot of people would feel anxious about this because they would say, how can you randomly assign somebody who's being sentenced for a crime to one sentence or another? Surely that's unfair.
It's unfair for sentence to be assigned without a background knowledge of how effective those sentences are, so that when doctors evaluate a new medicine, they don't consider it unfair to know whether the medicine works or not.
But I would still feel very hard done by if I was a heroin addict who was being sentenced for stealing people's mobile phones, and I knew that on the toss of a coin, I might get a custodial sentence or compulsory drug treatment.
When you go into prisons, as often as I've done, and talk to offenders, they are very familiar with the idiosyncrasies of conventional sentencing. And they can line up a few of their peers who've done essentially the same things and have vastly different sentences.
That's very interesting, because in medicine we talk about arbitrary variation in care as a justification for doing a randomised trial. And you're saying we have exactly the same situation in criminal justice.
Indeed. Judges, in effect, use a limited set of sentences. So mostly if you're sentenced to prison, if it's a short sentence, it'll be a multiple of 30 days. If it's a slightly longer sentence, it'll be a multiple of 90 days.
Almost like dosages of pills.
Exactly like the dosages of pills.
In medicine, whether you're a GP or a hospital doctor, if you prescribe a treatment and it fails, probably that patient will come back to you. If the patient dies, you will sign the death certificate in all likelihood. Judges don't have to see the consequences of their decisions. Do you think that impacts on their ability to appreciate the need for long-term evidence?
That's a very strong point, Ben, and it applies particularly, for example, to injecting drug users. If they do not appear before the court, that may be either because they have recovered from their drug addiction and been rehabilitated,
or they might be dead.
Or they have died from a drug overdose or a suicide, or they've been a homicide victim. So success and failure look the same to the bench.
Archie Cochrane is the great-grandfather of evidence-based medicine, and he described having stand-up rows with surgeons in the 70s about their refusal to do fair tests to see whether their treatments worked or not. What happens when you raise these ideas with judges?
Well, I have had the privilege of discussing them with a number of senior judges who understand very well the principle of randomisation and the need for like-with-like comparison. But after an extended conversation on the topic, one such senior judge said to me, the business of judging is to judge. And so, in a sense, if you randomise the sentence, then what's my place in judgment?
To me, this is clear. Judges, politicians, civil servants and doctors all come up with interventions they think are reasonable. But if we don't know which one of those is the best, which is most likely to achieve our stated objectives, then we need to show some humility and run a fair test. It's hard to embrace uncertainty, to admit that sometimes we don't know what works best, especially if you're someone who spent their whole life in social roles specifically designed to project authority. But inserting some constructive, carefully constrained humility back into those roles is perhaps the greatest challenge of all.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.